Monster Man, special episode, Beholder.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon supporters, and in particular, of Patreon supporter Robert, one of my longest-running backers and an old friend. Today, Robert has asked me to talk about the Beholder, one of the most iconic monsters from Dungeons & Dragons, and one that we haven't really talked about in a while. If you'd like to be like Robert and get your own special episode, remember that all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the $2 tier reward, which is access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, and the $1 tier reward, which is periodic bonus content and my heartfelt thanks on this show. So Robert, thank you once again very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. So, the last time that we really talked about the Beholder on Monster Man was over 3 years ago. That was in episode number 4, whereas Tuesday's episode was episode number 317, you know, not counting the special episodes, which don't have numbers. So I thought I would just quickly go over what I said about the Beholder then. I talked about how interesting the Beholder is, and how, unlike most monsters that you would encounter in Dungeons & Dragons, so unlike orcs, or dragons, or skeletons, it is a very specifically D&D monster. In honor, it probably shares with, like, the Mind Flayer and the Owlbear, probably the other two most recognizable ones, but I think that the Beholder, probably the best known of these creatures. In that episode, I called it, quote, a masterpiece of excess, and I said, quote, it goes so far over the top that it has a redemptive wackiness. Because the Beholder is not only, you know, not something that has a folkloric or mythological background, but it's something that never could have. It was probably the best-known monster that is original to D&D. It's not derived from some kind of literary precedent that I'm aware of. And I think, you know, if you are listening to this show, then there is a good chance that you are steeped in the imagery and iconography of fantasy gaming. That you are, not to put too fine a point on it, a fantasy gaming nerd. I certainly am. And from that point of view, from that perspective, it can be hard to realize how weird the Beholder is, because we're just so used to it. If you're like me, you know, Beholders, like, I'm not from an era where there were no Beholders in D&D and then they were added. You know, you'd have to have been playing the game very early for that. The Beholder first appears in Greyhawk, which comes out before I'm born. So we are used to the Beholder, and because we're used to it, we look at it and we don't really see how strange it is. If the Beholder as a monster came out today, it would not be in like a WotC monster book. It would be an acid death fantasy or something. It's much closer to the gonzo, quote-unquote, art punk end of the OSR than to anything that kind of mainstream fantasy gaming is putting out in the year 2020, at least in its original form. So let's talk about the beginnings of that publication history. The Beholder is a monster from Gary Gygax's home campaign, the famous Greyhawk campaign, but it was not created by Gygax himself, at least not solely by Gygax himself. It was actually created by one of Gygax's players, Terry Kuntz. He was one of the first group of players to play in the Greyhawk campaign who was not a member of the Gygax family, and he is, I mean, I hate to say this, but he is perhaps best known as the brother of the somewhat more prominent old-school D&D person, Rob Kuntz. And if you are into the history of Greyhawk, which I am not, you may recognize Terry as the player of Terrick, which I believe is just a fantastification of Terry K, in the same way that his brother Rob played Robilar. Many of the Greyhawk characters' names are just anagrams or puns or plays on words based on the names of the actual players, like Jim Ward is Dromage, and Ernest Gygax is Tenser, which is an anagram of Ernest, and so on and so forth. It's all in good fun. I was thinking about this and sort of like, oh, well, you know, we wouldn't do that in this day and age. Like, we design characters a little, you know, more thoughtfully than that. And I thought, like, actually, that would give me a character called Jamesh, which is not bad. That's not a bad name, right? If I just went James H. Jamesh. That's not terrible. So perhaps they were onto something. Anyway, the idea was subsequently expanded on by Gygax. That's what he says, is that Terry came up with the idea and then Gygax, like, refined it. I don't know precisely what that entails, but my guess would be that the basic concept of a floating eye monster and the eye stalks having different powers originates with Terry Kuntz, and then that maybe that Gygax determines what those powers are and the mechanics and stuff. I don't know, but I'm sure I could find out. Like, Greyhawk has been quite detailed, has been studied a lot, but the point is that it's created by one of the players, and it's not the only monster to have that kind of pedigree, which I think is interesting. You know, quite early on in the history of Dungeons & Dragons, it seems to be relatively well understood that players are actually going to contribute creatively to the game, or that every player is a potential GM. And so, of course, the Beholder then is first published in the Greyhawk supplement when that comes out in, I think, 1975. But the Beholder, as it first appears in, first in Greyhawk, and then in 77, it's in the Monster Manual, although that is very recognizably the Beholder that exists today, they're not exactly the same. It has been constantly expanded and developed. And one of the most significant of those developments comes in the ecology of the Beholder. Well, actually, I'm not so sure about this. If you read about the history of the Beholder, people will tell you that one of the most significant developments is from an article that comes out in Dragon Magazine number 76, that's in 1983, The Ecology of the Beholder by Ed Greenwood and Roger Moore. And I am not sure that it really adds all that much in substance, but it changes a lot about the Beholder in tone, if that makes sense. As with some of the previous special episodes, we have a special guest to read some of this article for us. So I'm just going to turn you over to Tom McGrenery. Tom is the co-host of the podcast Fear of a Black Dragon, which I am a big fan of. I think if you like Monster Man, there's a very good chance that you'll enjoy Fear of a Black Dragon, so you should go and check it out. It's about combining old-school role-playing and more recent games, or more recent systems, or more recent gaming concepts. It's a really thought-provoking and well-informed podcast. I really enjoy listening to it. You may remember Tom as a guest of the show, where he came on to talk about monsters in the role-playing game The Elephant and Macaw Banner. So Tom, take it away.
"Many tales are told," began the sage, "of the dreaded Eye Tyrants." At the mention of this name, the restless students sitting around him in the outdoor amphitheatre grew quiet. The sage smiled and continued, "You've listened to stories of these fantastic creatures, seemingly born to the art of destruction, wild tales of battle done with them, of the sorcerous powers of their many eyes, of their rich hoards of treasure. But few have cared to learn much of the habits and nature of these creatures. Know you now that I have studied the Beholder for many seasons, and can tell you in truth what was not known before. The Beholder is shaped like a great sphere, almost the height of a man. The body is covered by several hard plates of chitin, which overlap one another slightly, protecting the internal organs. A magical organ called the Loator Magnus, located in the center of the body, surrounded by the creature's brain, produces an influence that causes the Beholder to float in the air. This allows it to move about slowly, up and down, left or right, forward or back, at a slow speed like that of a pacing man. No magical spell or device can negate this levitation, though Beholders cannot resist the push of great winds. Most of them lair underground, where they may go as they will, while others move about in desolate, windless areas, where few other creatures will go. The sage settled himself against the stone table he used for a lectern. The lifespan of a Beholder is unknown, but thought to be very long indeed. One specimen has survived, if the legends about it can be trusted, for 900 seasons. As for social and philosophical aspects of the Beholder's existence, your guess is equal mine for accuracy. They desire the extinction of all species but themselves, and those they can manipulate to increase their power and influence. This is almost all that is known of their innermost thoughts and designs. Though evil, they are prone to lawfulness as well, and may take on servant creatures by duress or charm to serve as guardians of treasure or as guardians of the Beholder's personal safety. These servant creatures are also a means of implementing the Eye Tyrant's plans to carry destruction to all other life it encounters and accumulate magical treasure. Gargoyles are highly favoured for such uses, since they are too stupid and too undisciplined to resist the beholder's demands, and not powerful enough to give their master discomfort, and perhaps bring about their annihilation. The sage paused for a breath, and then continued with, "We now come to reproduction."
Thanks for that, Tom. The rest of the article, I mean, this is just a small extract from it. The rest of the article focuses on, you know, kind of more of what you'd expect given what you've just heard. There's stuff about how beholders excrete, how they reproduce, fancy long-winded ways of saying the same information that's found in the monster manual. I mean, and note, as Tom pointed out when we discussed this, the emphasis on, like, dealing with what beholders do in high winds, which just, like, the idea of beholders being afraid to go outside because they don't want to bob around like a balloon in a gust of wind is, I mean, it's either brilliant or idiotic, and I'm not sure which. I think that that article is interesting on a number of levels, but maybe it's less interesting for what it says about the beholder itself than what it says about the game's attitude toward the beholder, if those things can be distinguished. I find this article, I mean, my views on TSR's writing in the 80s are well known. I think it's repetitive and overwritten. But that, you know, partly that's just a consequence of changing standards over the decades, right? It is very typical of game writing at the time, and a different voice might very well have stood out. This article is widely regarded as being like a significant impact on the development of the beholder, and for the life of me, I cannot figure out why, because it tells us a lot of stuff that, as far as I'm concerned, nobody cares about the beholder, like how do they poop, and doesn't tell us stuff like what do they want. Well, apparently they just kind of want evil. They're sort of uncomplicatedly villainous, and there's nothing wrong with that. I describe them in my notes as Jack Kirby supervillains, but like, I'm not talking about Baron Bedlam here. I'm talking about like Annihilus. You know, they just hate things, they like to destroy things, they like to collect magical treasure. For what purpose? Who knows? He's collecting a magical suit of armor, he can't wear it, who knows? And then this article seems very interested in layering these kind of like pseudo-ecological trappings onto the frankly kind of ludicrous, but that's okay, core concept of the beholder. But as D&D goes through the 80s, it seems to get a bit embarrassed about some of the more ridiculous aspects of it. AD&D anyway, actually, one of the things I think we're learning from the creature catalog is that there's less of that kind of thing. Now, having said that, I did say to my wife Allison, oh, this article is so full of pointless detail, like, is the thing that you want to know about beholders that they puke up bones like an owl? And she said, yes, absolutely. So, you know, maybe I'm just being close-minded and not seeing the fun in this. But this is also predictive of a broader trend for the beholder, because the beholder is subject to two processes that seem to affect every monster in Dungeons & Dragons that becomes popular. Several processes that affect every monster in Dungeons & Dragons that becomes popular. The first is that the monster begins to become investigated in increasingly specific detail, and nowhere is that more obvious than in the second edition book, I, Tyrant, which is a 96-page, I think, Beholder supplement, and which I believe I did once own. Or maybe I just borrowed it from... Ted, did you have that book? I don't know. Anyway, it was a long time ago. I've forgotten. So that's the first. In endless dissection of the minutiae of these monsters. The second is that large numbers of variants of those monsters begin to be spun out. Knowing that they were onto a winner, TSR created any number of variant beholders, and I'd like to contend that these variant beholders are of diminishing effect. So, in addition to the regular old beholder that we all know and love, there are also the Bloodkiss Beholder, Death Tyrant, Elder Orb, Eye of Flame, Eye of Frost, Eye of Shadow, Ghost Beholder, Hive Mother, Deathkiss, Director, Eye of the Deep, Goth, Gazer, Gouger, Observer, Overseer, and Spectator. I'm particularly disappointed in all these ones that are just synonyms for Watcher. Again, it's not that there's anything individually wrong with any of these monsters. Taken on their own terms, many of them are fine. But they have the effect, like, by trying to contextualize the Beholder, they actually take away some of the Beholder's appeal, which is that it's so distinctive and weird. The beholder is a monster that almost functions better without context. Indeed, many explanations of the beholders suggest, like, in some editions of the game, they're said to come from the Far Realm, that mysterious other world of chaos and dreams, or to be from outer space, or whatever, right? And that relies on the idea that they are fundamentally alien to this reality, or to the reality of the Prime Material Plane, to the ontology that player characters are familiar with. And even though it sort of makes sense that there wouldn't just be like this one type of creature that inhabits that other reality, it does somehow nonetheless dilute their uniqueness when you bring in all these other monsters without really replacing that uniqueness with anything that's worth the trade. Now, I think, and I'm going to talk about that in a second, but I think that there is something that you can do with this concept that ties into how Beholders were later developed. I'll get to it in a moment. Okay, third, and this happens with every other popular monster, say maybe Mind Flayers? They have become friendly. Everybody likes the good dragons. Strahd is perceived as a, you know, either as a noble romantic figure or more commonly as a lovable goof. Owlbears are cuddly mascots. And Beholders have become likable. Notice the elevation of the Forgotten Realms character Xanathar to a sort of mascot status, even though Xanathar is nominally a villain, but it's a process that's aided by the fact that he is so fundamentally silly looking. This happens to all successful villains, and it is just the way it works. It happened to Dracula, it happened to Cthulhu, it happened to Doctor Doom, it's just, that's how it goes. If the fans like to see the character, they will begin to like the character, if that makes sense. But, again, it replaces the Beholder's exoticism with familiarity, which is maybe a problem. Again, is that thing that we don't notice because we are jaded to the weirdness of the Beholder. One of the things that I think this proliferation of detail about the Beholder and this proliferation of other types of Beholder reveals is that no one knows what makes an icon. No one knows why the Beholder is so successful, in a way that, like, I don't know, the Hook Horror is not, or the Umber Hulk. They both have their advocates. I'm not dissing either of those monsters, but the Beholder, they're not. So again, TSR feels they're onto a winner, so there's a strong compulsion to, like, do more Beholder stuff. Well, what if a Beholder was a vampire? What if a Beholder was a ghost? What if a Beholder was a baby? Etc., etc. They have a little bit of the Ring of Mogo the Bat Ape about them, right? Oh, well, you kids like Batman, right? Well, what if it was an ape? But within all this, some of the later development of the Beholder is actually really good. So, for example, Beholders are, they're kind of racists, but they're racists in a way that sort of is, like, funny and strange enough to not really add a note of seriousness that they maybe couldn't bear, right? If we were putting in, like for real eugenics content into the D&D game, we would typically want to do that in a way that was a little more serious than a floating globe of eyes could really stand. But the Beholder version of eugenics is kind of grimly humorous in a way that I think allows them to get away with it. Not get away with it in the sense, I mean, Beholders are presented as believing these things, and Beholders are presented as monstrous villains, but at the same time, the situation is absurd enough that you're not trivializing a serious issue by putting it into the mouth of a big ball of eyes. Specifically, Beholders believe in exterminating all creatures that are not perfect. They believe that Beholders are perfect, and they further believe that they specifically are the perfect Beholder, and all other Beholders are inferior variations. So in fact, they're all racists for a race of one. Able to cooperate under duress, yes, but typically they all hate each other, which is why they surround themselves with minions and lackeys rather than working together. It makes them boss monsters, and under certain circumstances, good allies, because it may well be that they actually despise their rival Beholders more than they despise you. You could, for instance, take all the different weird characteristics of all these variant Beholders and just assign them to individual Beholders as personality traits or at specific variations. So there's no longer the Bloodkiss Beholder, which is like a vampire Beholder, basically. You know, that's this particular Beholder, and that's what that Beholder's weird power is. So, you know, the Eye of the Deep just becomes like, oh yeah, that particular Beholder lives underwater. And so then the variation within the Beholder species becomes more pronounced. As it is, the only variation I think that's written into the description is that the 10 eyes are not in the same layout for every Beholder. And the Ecology of the Beholder actually says that the DM should always make a note of which eyes are which, because they don't all, like, rotate 360 degrees. They all have certain firing arcs, and you know, but the players don't, which eye stalks are which. You want to find out which one is Disintegrate, which one is Death Ray, so that you're not on those sides. You're fine if you're on the side that has telekinesis. So, they're xenophobic genetic supremacist culture ties in with them being just abominably villainous, but in a way that I think doesn't cross the line into trivializing a serious issue. I don't know where a lot of that stuff comes from. It's in Second for sure, but I don't know if it originates prior to that. I don't know if it's a Spelljammer thing. The Monster Manual 1 just calls them hateful, aggressive, and avaricious, and says they attack on sight, which is a bit, whatever. But I like the idea that they remain hateful, aggressive, and avaricious. I see these guys as having kind of a Cobra Commander type of personality. Like a real megalomaniacal comic book supervillain scumbag. But unlike Cobra Commander, maybe powerful enough to back it up such that you can't just scoff at them. I mean, again, I already said, Annihilus. There's a great article, I don't even remember, I think it was on Dave's Longbox, but I could be wrong. That was an old comic book blog in the early 2000s that was talking about the Fantastic Four villain Annihilus, and it described him as representing a type of Marvel villain that this blogger called the Ranting Powerhouse. He says, you know, being a successful supervillain is all about branding. Annihilus has a monstrous, frightening appearance and reinforces this initial impression by A, annihilating things, and B, raving like a maniac. And I think if you give the beholder that like bombastic Lee Kirby supervillain personality, I think that really works for them. And then they could have all their like scumbag brainwashed servants, you know, zooming into battle going, die for Darkseid or whatever. I think there's something there to it, particularly if, like Robert, you're planning to use these guys in a Spelljammer context. I think theatrically villainous is actually a pretty good initial point of contact. All right, so that is about all the time that we have to talk about Beholders today. Robert, I hope that you enjoyed your special episode. Thank you very much for continuing to support Monster Man. If you'd like to be like Robert and support the show and get your own special episode, remember that all you got to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Or you can pledge at another level of your choice. All up to you. Thanks once again to Tom for being our guest reader today. Don't forget to check out Fear of a Black Dragon and The Elephant and Macaw Banner. I'll put some links down in the show notes. In our next episode, we'll be returning to our journey through Creature Catalog, and we're going to go under the sea and, in one case, under the surface of the desert as we talk about the Leviathan and the Masher. All of that next time on a very worm-focused episode of Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.